Good evening. Welcome to Dominican University of California. This is the sleepiest day of the year here on campus. We had graduation on Saturday. We have 1 week of no classes. Didn't we plan this well for you? Absolutely. My name is Denise Lucy. I'm the executive director of the Institute for Leadership Studies and a professor of business here, and very happy to be the partner of Book Passage for this lecture series. And I'm wondering if this is your first time to our lecture series. If so, could you raise your hand? Many too many of you have not been here before, and we hope that you will fill out a card and let us invite you to future programs. Our Leadership Institute is a leadership development center, and our lecture series seeks to engage our students, our faculty, and our campus community with you around important topics related to leadership across the disciplines. So our Book Passage partnership, this is our 79th lecture together with Book Passage over the last 10 years. And Eve Ensler was here a year ago, in fact, 1 week after we actually did the Vagina Monologues on campus, and she was spectacular in challenging us and the world to partake in the 1 Billion Rising, which was this Valentine's Day. And our students and faculty and staff did that. We rallied, we marched downtown, we flash mobbed, and it was absolutely important. And thank Eve for mobilizing the world. 1 billion people rose. Now, our very important supporters, Private Ocean Wealth Management, have now supported us for 2 full years. That's 26 lectures. Without their help, we could not do this. They are really focused on community, and we want to thank them, and please join me in doing so. Private Ocean Wealth Management. Now, before I introduce Elaine Petruccelli, who will introduce Ms. Ensler, I'd like to just say a thank you to my faculty and staff colleagues who have volunteered their evening tonight to help welcome you. And this is so nice of them, isn't it? To help make you feel welcome. And they are regulars, and we have a regular that actually has worked for the Institute and for me. He was a student for 4 years. He graduated last May, and his name is Nick Parrish. And tonight, I'd like to surprise him. He doesn't know I'm doing this. Nick, would you please come out? I want to publicly thank you for what you've done as a student in support of this institute and of me personally, and for helping us make this program so special, and for getting us tech savvy. And we have something for you. Take a bow. This is Nick's last day, and he's working for Marin County, and his supervisor is sitting right here, Joanne Peterson. Thank you for hiring him. And we really adore and love you, Nick, and we know that you'll join us as an alumnus and as a friend, and thank you for your support. It's my pleasure to introduce Elaine Petruccelli. Does she need an introduction? Not really. But I'm going to do it, because no one really introduces Elaine Petruccelli, and she deserves it. She founded Book Passage over 30 years ago. Yeah. And she's developed it into a community center, not just here in Marin and Corte Madera, but also in San Francisco at the Ferry Building. Yes, do please shop there. She has over 700 lecture events every year. Imagine, we do 2013 and we're going crazy. She does 700. And many of the unknown authors who have actually spoken in these events at her stores credit her for their fame. And it's just numerous people who have benefited from her support. Book Passage also has classes, French and Italian, and also these cool summer conferences in travel writing, in mystery writing, in children's writing, where her famous authors are the faculty. She's really a remarkable entrepreneur, and it is my privilege to call her our friend, Elaine Petruccelli.
That was so sweet. I feel so lucky that I do get to do what I do, and I get all the credit, and there are 72 people who work at Book Passage in different capacities, some part-time, some are paid full-time but work triple-time, people like Karen West, who is our events director, and that's how we do it, and also because of this community we have. And every time I call Denise and say, Denise, what do you think? And I think anybody else would say, that's too much work, I've had too many lectures already. Denise, I can see the yellow pad coming out. It's probably her computer, but, and she starts saying, well, what do we need to do to make this happen? She has taught me how to be a leader, and I'm very, very lucky. I'm also very lucky that one of the things that this job and this lecture series that Private Ocean and others have been so generous about has brought me into the world of Eve Ensler. I had always admired Eve Ensler. I've seen the Vagina Monologues so many times that it's sort of like Goodnight Moon to me. And I understand there is a young woman in the audience tonight who has just been appointed to produce Vagina Monologues over at Berkeley, and I'll be there, don't worry. That Vagina Monologues has been translated into 48 languages. It's been shown in at least 140 countries. This I got off the web. It's probably out of date. There's probably more by now. Her books are phenomenal because they are so open, so beautifully and almost poetically written. But she is also the founder of V-Day, the global movement that's going to end violence. V-Day has raised over $100 million over a very short time for grassroots organizations around the world. When you read In the Body of the World, you will get a really close picture of the City of Joy in Congo and see how this all works. Last year, when Eve was here, she inspired us all so much that Dominican University did a 1 million rising on Valentine's Day. If you were in San Rafael, you saw the march down the street, the dancing, the joy of it all. It's going to happen again, February 14th, 2013, and that, 2014. And it will happen again and again until we stop violence. I could bore you forever with all of Eve's awards. I'm not going to. I could list all of her books, but my friends out there want to sell them to you so you can go find them. I do have to tell you about In the Body of the World. I picked it up one evening, I got into bed, I thought, I'll read a few pages. I never went to sleep that night. I laughed and I cried a lot. I finally had to get out of bed and pace the floor, because this book is so profound. Eve rips off all of the drapes, and we not only see her, but the world, and you are in for a huge revelation. Isabel Allende, who is a friend of Dominican and of Book Passage, and of many of us here, never, ever writes blurbs for anybody's books, and there are authors in this audience who can attest to that. She doesn't because she doesn't want to say no to anybody, so she says no to everybody. But this book moved her so much that this is what she wrote. She wrote a long thing, but I'm only going to take a bit. She writes as though her heart and body are broken, but her anger is like fire, and the passion of her writing rattles your soul. This is true literature and true activism. Don't miss this book. And we aren't going to, because we are going to welcome Eve Ensler. Thank you.
Rye.
Thank you.
A million rising! Woo! Oh, I'm so happy to be here, and I'm overwhelmed by that introduction. Thank you, Elaine. Thank you, everyone here tonight. What incredible energy, love. Thank you. I just want to thank Elaine. You know, one of the amazing things traveling across this country, I've been in a lot of cities in the last few weeks, and I just want to honor Book Passage. I want to honor bookstores. I want to honor Elaine's commitment to culture and changing our spirits and keeping our souls alive through bringing culture and keeping culture forward. And I just want to take a moment to honor her work and her life commitment to that and all she's done at Book Passage to make sure that's happened. So thank you, Elaine. Thank you, Elaine. I love this university. I just love it. I had such an amazing time here last year, and I just want to thank the president, who I had the privilege of having dinner with tonight, President Mary Marcy, for her incredible leadership, for building a community that is a web of connection and is about a circle as opposed to a tower. And you can just feel that in everything in the spirit of this place. And I want to thank Denise Lucy, who is such a leader, who makes so much happen, and she does it with a spirit of so much love and so much commitment and so much tenacity. And just everything that happened here at One Billion Rising, I just need to take a moment to thank all of the students and all of the teachers and everybody who made One Billion Rising rock here this year. It's unbelievably fabulous. So thank you. Thank you. I just want you all to know that I spent, before I left for this book tour, I spent a weekend, 4 days in a room with all the videos that were starting to come in from across the planet. And there are thousands and thousands and thousands of videos. We really did it. We got a billion women and men to rise to end violence against women and dance. We did it. And it's so beautiful. We're going to have a documentary ready in the fall to inspire everybody for next year. But when you see how this energy and what it was an energy spread across the planet. And our motto was not branding, expanding, because we're over branding. We're into expanding now. And the idea was to take this idea of 1 billion rising and make it yours and bring it into your communities just the way you did here. And when you see women in Bhutan dancing with butter lamps on their heads, and you see women in Mogadishu, in the streets of Mogadishu. Somalian women have never danced in the streets of Mogadishu, the first time in their black chadors and red short skirts with the First Lady of Somalia with them. I mean, you just see, you know, young women in their rooms in Tehran dancing in front of their iPhones, and women, I was with the 9 or 10 members of the European Parliament who took over the European Parliament in a flash mob. I was there when we did that, you know. So we saw miracles from the International Criminal Court to the UN, which actually shut down and had had their own rising at the UN, and it happened. And we can go further. Now we know what we can do, so we can really go all the way and end violence against women and girls. Yes, we can. I'm so happy to be here tonight to talk about this new book, and I just want to say a couple things before I begin. You know, this book is the most personal thing I've ever written, and it kind of was the diagnosis of cancer, the treatment of cancer, and then the book, and I thought that was kind of the whole cancer conversion process until I started doing the tour, and then I realized stage 4 was the tour. because in a way, this book wrote me. It came after the treatment ended, and it was if my body had imprinted everything upon it that I had gone through, and then when it was over, it all just wrote itself in this very, like a fever. But I don't think I realized what I had written until I started reading it on this book tour, and it was a bit startling. It's made me much more open and porous than I had bargained for, but then I realized that was the point of the book. So I want to say that I feel very, 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 very privileged to be standing here tonight. I feel very, very, very privileged to be alive. And I don't take that lightly. I realize that I had the privilege of having medical care that 90% of the world doesn't have that kept me alive. And I have gratitude the size of the sky for life. And I want to say that before I begin. So, with that, Thank you. Thank you. So I want to begin by reading the introduction to the book. The book is done in a series of scans, as in CAT scan, because I became obsessed with CAT scans because I was having so many of them. And I kind of really got into CAT scans after a while, and just the liquid being shot into you and the whole thing, it was just really mysterious and super sci-fi. And at one point, I started to discover and investigate, and the CAT scan machine is really amazing because it takes individual shots, but the computer makes it seem like one. And it seemed to me that so much of the way storytelling is that we tell sometimes stories in these fragmented or fractured ways, and hopefully, cumulatively, they add up to be one. So the book is told in scans, but this is the introduction, and it's called Divided. A mother's body against a child's body makes a place. It says, you are here. Without this body against your body, there is no place. I envy people who miss their mother, or miss a place, or know something called home. The absence of a body against my body created a gap, a hole, a hunger. This hunger determined my life. I have been exiled from my body. I was ejected at a very young age, and I got lost. I did not have a baby. I have been afraid of trees. I have felt the earth as my enemy. I did not live in the forests. I lived in the concrete city where I could not see the sky or sunset or stars. I moved at the pace of engines, and it was faster than my own breath. I became a stranger to myself and to the rhythms of the earth. I aggrandized my alien identity and wore black and felt superior. My body was a burden. I saw it as something that unfortunately had to be maintained. I had little patience for its needs. The absence of body against my body made attachment abstract, made my own body dislocated and unable to rest or settle. A body pressed against your body is the beginning of nest. I grew up not in a home, but in a kind of freefall of anger and violence that led to a life of constant movement, of leaving and falling. It is why at one point I couldn't stop drinking and fucking, why I needed people to touch me all the time. It had less to do with sex than location. When you press against me or put yourself inside me, when you hold me down or lift me up, when you lie on top of me, I can feel your weight. I exist. I am here. For years, I have been trying to find my way back to my body and to the earth. I guess you could say it's been a preoccupation. Although I have felt pleasure in both the earth and my body, it's been more as a visitor than as an inhabitant. I've tried various routes to get back: promiscuity, anorexia, performance art. I've had spent time by the Adriatic and the green Vermont mountains, but always I felt estranged, just as I was estranged from my own mother. I was in awe of her beauty, but could not find my way in. Her breasts were not the breasts that fed me. Everyone admired my mother in her tight tops and leggings, with her hair in a blonde French twist, as she drove through our small, rich town in her yellow convertible. One gawked at my mother. One desired my mother. And so I gawked and desired the earth and my mother, and I despised my own body, which was not her body. My body that I had been forced to evacuate when my father invaded and then violated me. And so I lived as a breathless, rapacious machine programmed for striving and accomplishment. Because I could not inhabit my body or the earth, I could not feel or know their pain. I could not intuit their unwillingness or refusals, and I most certainly never knew the boundaries of enough. I was driven. I called it working hard, being busy, on top of it, making things happen. But in fact, I could not stop. Stopping would mean experiencing separation, loss, tumbling into a suicidal dislocation. As I had no reference point for my body, I began to ask other women about their bodies, in particular, their vaginas. I sensed early on that vaginas were important. This led me to writing the vagina monologues, which then led me to talking incessantly and obsessively everywhere about vaginas. I did this in front of strangers. As a result of me talking so much about vaginas, women started telling me stories about their vaginas and their bodies. I crisscrossed the earth in planes, trains, and jeeps. I was hungry for the stories of other women who had experienced violence and suffering. These women and girls had also become exiled from their bodies, and they too were desperate for a way home. I went to over 60 countries. I heard about women being molested in their beds, flogged in their burqas, acid burned in their kitchens, left for dead in parking lots. I went to Juarez, Jalalabad, Sarajevo, Alabama, Port-au-Prince, Peshawar, Pristina. I spent time in refugee camps, in burned-out buildings and backyards, in dark rooms where women whispered their stories by flashlight. Women showed me their ankle lashes and melting faces, the scars on their bodies from knives and burning cigarettes. Some could no longer walk or have sex. Some became quiet and disappeared. Others became driven machines like me. Then I went somewhere else. I went outside what I thought I knew. I went to the Congo. And I heard stories that shattered all the other stories. In 2007, on invitation, I landed in Bukavu, Democratic Republic of Congo. I heard stories that got inside my body. I heard about the girl, a little girl, who couldn't stop peeing on herself because huge men had shoved themselves inside her. I heard about an 80-year-old woman whose legs were broken and torn out of their sockets when the soldiers pulled them over her head and raped her. There were thousands of these stories. The stories saturated my cells and nerves. I stopped sleeping. All the stories began to bleed together. The raping of the earth, the pillaging of minerals, the destruction of vaginas, they were not separate from each other or from me. In the Congo, there has been a war raging for nearly 13 years. Almost 8 million people have died, and hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of women have been raped and tortured. It is an economic war fought over minerals that belong to the Congolese but are pillaged by the world. There are local and foreign militias from Rwanda, Burundi, Uganda. They enter villages and they murder. They rape wives in front of their husbands. They force the husbands and sons to rape their daughters and sisters. They shame and destroy families, and they take over the villages and the mines. The minerals are abundant in the Congo. Tin, copper, coltan, which are used in our iPhones, our PlayStations, and computers. Of course, by the time I got to Congo, I had witnessed the epidemic of violence toward women that scoured the planet. But the Congo was where I witnessed the end of the body, the end of humanity. Femicide, the systematic rape, torture, and destruction of women and girls, was being employed as a military corporate tactic to secure minerals. Thousands and thousands of women were not only exiled from their bodies, but their bodies and the functions and futures of their bodies were rendered obsolete, wombs and vaginas permanently destroyed. The Congo and the individual horror stories of her women consume me. Here I began to see the future, a monstrous vision of global disassociation and greed that not only allowed but encouraged the eradication of the female species in pursuit of minerals and wealth. But I found something else in the Congo as well. Here, inside the stories of unspeakable violence, inside the women of the Congo, was a determination and a life force I had never witnessed. There was grace and gratitude, fierceness and readiness. Inside this world of atrocities and horror was a red, hot energy on the verge of being born. The women had hunger and dreams, demands and a vision. They conceived of a place and they built it, a concept called City of Joy. It would be their sanctuary. It would be a place of safety, of healing, of gathering strength, of coming together, of revolution, of releasing their pain and trauma. A place where they would declare their joy and power, a place where they would rise as leaders. I, along with my team and the wonderful women on my board, were committed to finding the resources and energy to help them build it and fulfill their dreams. We would work with UNICEF to do the construction, and then after V-Day would find the way to support it. The process of building was arduous and seemingly impossible. Delayed by rain, lack of roads, no electricity, corrupt building managers, poor oversight by UNICEF, and rising prices, we were scheduled to open in May, but on March 17, 2010, they discovered a huge tumor in my uterus. Cancer threw me through the window of my disassociation into the center of my body's crisis. The Congo threw me deep into the crisis of the world. And these two experiences merged as I faced the disease and what I felt was the beginning of the end. So that's how it begins. I want to say that I wish I could tell you I wasn't aware that something was wrong with me long before I went to find out something was wrong with me. There's a scan in this book called Somnolence, and I think often, certainly for myself, but I would actually like to say I think most of the world is living in an ongoing state of somnolence where we're neither here nor there, half awake, half awake, half asleep. And that somnolence allows a lot to go on in our name, and it allows a lot of pain and a lot of hurt and a lot of disease to grow. And in fact, I saw the signs of my cancer at least a year before I did anything about it. But I was too busy adding up, too busy proving myself, too busy doing an I'll show you in the world. And I think for me, when I got the diagnosis, it was such a wake-up call, and it was so shocking, and it came so out of the blue, apparently. But it really didn't come out of the blue, but it knocked the blue out of the blue. And it was a Thursday when I got the diagnosis, and I had to give two speeches over the weekend, which I did for some insane reason. And I cried through all the speeches, and people thought I was really profound, but I was crying because I was sure I was going to die. And then I arrived on Monday at the Mayo Clinic. And I have to say, the Mayo Clinic is just one of the most extraordinary institutions I've ever had the privilege to be served by, and the care there was the closest we have to socialized medicine in this country. And I'm going to say one moment about healthcare. That every single person in this country and world does not have health care is a human travesty. And everybody has to get much more vigilant about demanding it happening. But I arrived on a Monday, and by Wednesday I was in 9-hour surgery. And when I woke up, my whole body was different. I had 7 body parts removed. I had pieces rearranged, I had parts reconstructed, I had lost a lot of, I think, 70 nodes, and I was body. I was body for the first time in my life. I had tubes coming out of me and catheters coming out of me, and for the first time in my life, I lay in this bed, and I was body. And it was really the beginning of what I now understand was a cancer conversion. I was really quite obsessed about the fact that the tumor was in my uterus. And it just seemed so ironic, considering my life. And I couldn't stop thinking about it, and I was on a lot of drugs. And you know, in the hospital now, they have this thing where you push a button anytime you feel pain. And the amazing nurses, who I will talk about later, because I worship nurses, and I just will do anything in my life for nurses for eternity. But they would come and they would say, "What's your pain, Eve?" Because they all had those accents. "What's your pain?" And I would say 8, because it always sounded like a good number, and I knew I could get the drugs. And and so they would say, "Okay, 8 is good," and I would hit the thing. And I want to say that in this period of being completely drugged on oxycodone, I was obsessed about my uterus. And so I'm going to read you from a little scan, which is called Uterus Equals Hysteria. What is most pressing now is why cancer in my uterus. Uterus, a hollow muscular organ in the pelvic cavity of female mammals in which the embryo is nourished and develops before birth. I try to imagine my uterus accommodating this tumor the way it might have once held a baby. I almost had 2 of them, babies. Is there a point to a uterus if you do not make a baby? Was the tumor a way of growing something? Was I growing a trauma baby? I remember years ago when I was going through a period when I seemed to be sick all the time, a shrink friend saying to me in that knowing and slightly patronizing, sorry for me kind of way, "You somatize, Eve, you do. You somatize." It was one of those words like individuate, I had to look it up. Somatize, how the body defends itself against too much stress, manifesting psychological distress as physical symptoms in the stomach or nerves or uterus or vagina. I read that women who had suffered physical, emotional, and sexual abuse tended to somatize more. It turns out that somatization is related to hysteria, which stems from the Greek cognate of uterus. Uterus equals hysteria. They always called me hysterical in my family. Extreme feeling, intense, Sarah Bernhardt. But what is extreme? Again, it depends on 10. I mean, what would be the appropriate level of emotional response to someone beating you daily, or calling you jackass, or stupid, or molesting you? What would be the non-hysterical response to living in a world where so many are eating dirt and swimming in the sewage system in Port-au-Prince to unclog the drains and find plastic bottles to sell? What would be the appropriate non-hysterical response to people blindfolding other people and walking them around naked on leashes or watching waving people being abandoned on rooftops in a flood? What would be the proper way to experience these things? Hysteria, a word to make women feel insane for knowing what we know. A word that has so many implications. Hysterical, out of control, insane, can't take her seriously, raving. Hysteria is caused by suffering from a huge trauma where there is an underlying conflict. So what was my conflict? Loving my mother and father, betraying my mother when my father molested me, wanting my father all to myself, even if it hurt my mother, witnessing and hearing the most horrific stories in the world inflicted on women's bodies and being unable to stop it in spite of every effort, wanting to fall in love and being totally unable to trust, hungering for connection and always finding it claustrophobic. What doesn't cause or produce conflicted feelings? What isn't traumatizing? So does removing my uterus mean they have removed my hysteria? I don't feel any less hysterical. Actually, the tubes and bags and needles are making me feel quite upset. And I wonder if there is such a thing as rape cancer. Do I have rape cancer? Do we get it if we've been molested or traumatized or raped? Are there rape cancer cells that get formed at the moment of violation and then get released into the bloodstream at another moment of trauma later in life? How many women with breast, vaginal, uterine, ovarian cancer have been raped or beaten or traumatized? Does anyone know? Would the Mayo do a study? Is there a way to cure rape cancer? Does each future trauma release more rape cancer cells? Is trauma cancer? Is this obsessing the reason I'm sick? Am I hysterical? Alert. 8, 8, 8, maybe even 9, I hit the oxycodone button. So after Mayo, I went back to New York and began a whole another journey, stage of the treatment. I was pricked and ported and I was body. When I got back to New York, I got very, very sick. And I got an intral abdominal affection, which occupied my entire gut. And they had to begin to take things and shove things into me and drain me at Sloan Kettering, which was a very different place, which was not a place of care. And it was very traumatizing. At the moment this began, it was the exact same day as the BP spill in the Gulf of Mexico. And it was really quite bizarre what began to happen. Because I couldn't get out of the Gulf. Do you remember that video cam of the oil gushing? I couldn't stop watching it. I realized I had other options, but I couldn't stop watching it. And it was as if my gut was the Gulf and the Gulf was my gut, and the pelicans, the oil-drenched pelicans that were washing up on the beaches, and the siphoning that was going on in the attempt to get the oil out of the Gulf and the infection out of my gut, it all began to become the same thing. And I lost all sight of what was what. And I realized what was beginning to happen was that this wall, that had been this almost like a boulder of disassociation that had been put there at the moment of my trauma early on, was beginning to melt away. And I was beginning to become porous, and I was beginning to become part of everything around me. And this continued on all different levels. And I always say, I think one of the greatest ironies of this journey is that this disease, cancer, which is a disease of psychotically subdividing cells, was the thing that was reuniting me and connecting me with everything around me. I love irony, and I love paradox. We better love it. We're right in the middle of it every single second. But I was really, really, really terrified of chemo. And after this infection went on for weeks and weeks, and I lost 30 pounds, and I was really beginning to disappear, I was ready to start chemo. And I couldn't imagine pumping poison into my bloodstream. Like, it was just an unfathomable idea. It seemed like such a replication of early abuse, like where something would invade your body that you had no control over and would consume you and kill you. And I wasn't going to do it. It was preventative at that point, and I had all these kind of excuses and stories about it being Western, and I was going through. And one day, and this kept happening all through my journey, this woman named Sue, who had been my former therapist and a genius, appeared at my loft, and she said, "I heard you have cancer, and I'm going to come, and I'm going to sit on your couch once a week, and I'm going to give you free sessions as my gift to V-Day." And of course, immediately I started to sob. And I said, "Well, you don't really need to be here because I'm not going to do chemotherapy." And she said, "Yes, you are." And I said, "No, I'm not." And we went back and forth. And I said, "I really don't think I can do it." I'm brave and I can handle things, but I can't handle poison in my body. And she looked at me and she did what I call a Sue, where you take one idea and you spin it on its head and you give it back to the person and a window opens and your brain opens and you are saved. And this is what she said to me. Eve, the chemo is not for you. It's for the cancer. It's for all the perpetrators, the past crimes. It's for your father. It's for the rapists. You're going to poison them now, and they are never coming back. Chemo will purge the badness that was projected onto you, but was never yours. I have total faith in your resilience and the magical capacities of your body and soul for healing. Your job is to welcome the chemo as an empathetic warrior who is coming in to rescue your innocence by killing off the perpetrator who got inside you. You have many bodies. New ones will be born out of this time, this transformational time of love and care. When you feel nauseous or terrible, just imagine how hard the chemo is fighting on your behalf and on behalf of all women's bodies, restoring wholeness, innocence, and peace. Welcome the chemo as an empathetic warrior. I could not wait to get to chemotherapy. It was amazing, and I want to say I think how we frame things completely determines our experience. I went each treatment for 5 hours and had chemo pumped into my bloodstream. And every hour, every minute that I sat there, I imagined something from the past that I wanted to burn away. Images of my childhood, images of stories I had heard around the world. I let the cancer burn in me and burn and burn and burn in me. And it went on for months. And I have to tell you, it worked. It worked. And I've been talking to a lot of oncologists about how we begin to reframe the chemo experience as a transformational experience. And we begin to get midwives and we begin to get spiritual people in transformational suites instead of infusion suites. And we call it transformational juice. And we begin to see how we can burn off our past. It was an amazing experience. And during those burning months, a lot of incredible things began to happen. I just want to go back a second because during the infection period, I was really sick, and I would become very, very lethargic and unable to function, and I would pass out, and I would have to go back into the hospital. And at one point, I had to go back into the hospital, and it was very close to my birthday, and my sister spoke to my mother, who was actually dying and began to die during my chemo, about getting me this room. And I had this private room, and I felt very spoiled, but it was this amazing room. And only thing in front of me was, out the window, was a tree. Now, I want you to know my history with trees was not good. I was very alienated from nature, and I had gone to school in Vermont, and as I drove to New York City, my last day, I said, I hope I never see another fucking tree. That was what came out of my mouth. So you can see how separated I was. I sat in this bed, or lay in this bed, and outside the window was this tree, and I thought, I will go out of my mind. I couldn't write, I couldn't work, I couldn't talk, I couldn't do anything but look at the tree. And on the first day, it was a little strange. And on the third day, I began to see the tree. And on the fourth day, I began to take in the tree. And on the sixth day, I fell in love with the tree. And I began to see branch.
And I began to see trunk. And I began to see leaves. And on the eighth day, I became the tree. And the last day in the hospital, the tree blossomed for me. And it was the beginning of this transformation into tree. And a great irony occurred that when I started to research the drugs that had been used in my chemo, one of them was Taxol, which is a drug that is made from the yew tree and the needles of the yew tree. So it turned out that a tree actually became my mother and saved my life. During that time, a lot of other amazing connections began to get made, and one of them was with my sister. And I think our relationships with our sisters are such crucial, crucial relationships and determine so much of the pathway of our life. And I grew up in a very violent family, and my father was a tyrannical patriarch who ruled by most
the way most patriarchs rule, which is by division and creating divisions and making sure people were pitted against each other. And of all the legacies of my father, this for me is the saddest one, how much he turned my brother and sister and I against each other and laid that wound into each of us, which was it felt impossible to heal. And when I got sick, I hadn't seen my sister for years, and it was a great, great source of pain in my soul. I woke up from my surgery, and my sister was standing there, and I actually thought I had died. And I said, oh my God, I'm dead, and I've gone to heaven, and we've been reunited, you know? But in fact, my sister had come to take care of me. And it was an incredible experience, because we both got what we needed from each other. I had been the older, brazen, hug up all the air and space, older sister. And she had been the younger, quiet, disappeared, younger sister. And what my sister wanted from me was for me to see her and listen to her and experience her as an equal and a human being. And I was so sick, I couldn't talk. So I asked questions, and my sister talked, and I got to know her. And I couldn't believe what an incredible human being she was. And my sister had witnessed me be abused every day of my childhood, and she felt incredibly helpless and incredibly guilty that she hadn't been able to take care of me, and she got to take care of me. And this incredible back and forth became this daily thing, and we couldn't separate from each other. And it was a certain point during this whole conversion process where we just looked at each other one day as we were eating roast chicken, and I said, I'm in love with you, and she said, I'm in love with you. And we had fallen madly in love with each other. And I have to say that healing has been such a profound healing. Like, I see how it's influenced every relationship I have, but particularly my relationships with my sisters in the world. So all that was going on. What also happened is that I fell in love with the ordinary. And I had been a person who never watched TV, because I think my deepest fear of life was that I would be a mall. Like, I would just be consumed into mall world. And my whole life was protecting myself against being mall, you know, whatever that was. And I ended up being a person who was addicted to Friday Night Lights, and I couldn't stop watching it, you know. And I had been a vegetarian for 30 years, and I woke up craving a hamburger. Everything was like opposite world. And I surrendered to it because I knew something was going on in me, some alchemy that I needed to pay attention to. But one of the things I was most struck by in this journey is the people around me who took care of me. And I want to talk a little bit about caregivers, because I think until you get really sick, you really don't understand caregivers, and you don't understand the depth of how care enters your pores. And if it's good care, it heals you, and if it's not good care, it hurts you. And when I was at the Mayo, the care that I got there was sublime care. It was care that was attentive and detailed and nuanced and so full of love that it was impossible not to get better. And I just want to take a moment to acknowledge caregivers, nurses, frontline people who work in clinics, who are on the front lines every day. You know, we live in such an ass-backward country. We honor and we worship and we hold high the people who rob our money and the people who steal from us and bankers and the people who weave a web around us and keep us alive and support us we don't even see. So I want to read this tonight for all the caregivers here and all the people who love by taking care of their parents or nursing or teaching or all the ways. And I'm going to do it for this woman. The scan is called Farting for Cindy. And by the way, Toast is a person named Tony who's with me and travels with me and has been with me as my everything, my friend, my runs my life, and he just was by my side every minute of my illness, and his name in the book is Toast, and Lou is my sister. Toast and Lou circle my bed as if their quiet moving back and forth will stimulate my bowels. The takedown's over, and the bag is gone. Everything is now about my bowels, my ability to control and direct my bowels and our bowels. I am on the fart floor, or the colon post-op floor, or the floor of missing bags. We are there, a tribe of us waiting to fart and poop. I meet them in the hall, the middle-aged, overweight male executive followed by his exhausted wife, the older, perfectly made-up, buxom blonde woman with a younger, skinny man following her in a wake of perfume. There are a group of us walking and walking because we're told walking makes you fart, makes you want to poop. I see them in their rooms still bedridden, and I see others leaving, going home, others who have clearly pooped their way back into the world. It is terrifying not being able to poop or fart. It's like shit claustrophobia. Everything gets stuck inside you and there is no way it will get out, and you just imagine yourself eventually exploding. I was honestly scared. Scared the operation had failed, scared nothing would ever work again and I would need another bag. I could tell Lou and Toast were scared too. They were on fart alert. Each morning they would arrive with great anticipation and I would shake my head. No farts, not even a shot of wind. It was going on for too long. Then they sent me Cindy, the fart deliverer. She went room to room. She was large, determined, and strong. The first time she came, she told me, "Eve, farts are music to my ears. I welcome farts. That's why I'm here. Do not be embarrassed. Give me your farts." I tried to imagine them saying something like this in Paris or Africa. It was so American. Give me your tired, your poor, your farts. Cindy knew all kinds of positions and tricks, places to press and pull. I surrendered to her big hands as she lifted and tossed me about. I could feel she was gifted. But my new redirected colon with shallow homemade rectum was having none of it. Cindy, fart massager, came every day at 3 p.m. I tried to imagine her life, bringing down the fart. Finding the perfect place or exact right moment when the colon released and the newly built body relaxed. I honestly think it was my need to please Cindy that brought on my first slight pass of gas. It was her fourth visit, and I could tell she was frustrated. She took her work seriously. Cindy was a volunteer. The fact that she didn't get paid for her fart work escalated my need to please her. If anything has kept my faith in humans, it is not the grand inventors or visionary poets or brain surgeons or even the Gandhis of the world. It is the Cindys, the quiet, invisible, often underpaid or unpaid Cindys who get up every morning and after feeding their families and taking care of their infirm parents, find their way on snowy country roads or polluted freeways to hospitals or old age homes or mental institutions or orphanages. Frequently unacknowledged, they take care of the poor, the privileged, the sick, the depraved. They weave an invisible web of care through the lonely mansions of Beverly Hills and emergency wards and mammogram clinics and infusion suites. As Cindy gently tossed me about, I thought of all the people like her who made me believe in love. The nannies and babysitters who helped me survive my childhood. Esther, who I met the first time I went to Pansy Hospital in Bukavu. I did not know her official title, but she was clearly the mama of the wounded. At any given time, there were around 200 women in the hospital who'd been raped or suffered trauma and were waiting for surgery or recovering from it. Esther knew every single one of their names and their children's names and the reason for their fevers and rashes, and she knew every detail of every woman's story. She created songs that reconstructed their narratives, and every day she danced with the survivors and played games with them. She transmitted her spirit into the broken, and each day they got stronger. I thought of Miss Pat, who saved her church, and Katrina, so she could serve gumbo to the homeless. Or Diane and Regina and the nurses at the Mayo. As I lay there, Cindy had worked up a sweat. She was gently pressing my lower abdomen. When the world is right, it will be the unpaid and unsung people like Cindy who will be the honored ones, the ones who get paid the most, and they will sit at the big table. When the world is right, it will be these invisible people who we see and cherish. I open my eyes and I see Cindy's face, and I know she is only here to help me get better. She has no other reason or agenda. She is so concentrated and so kind, I get seriously choked up and this distracts me. And suddenly, out of nowhere, there's a little pop, a breaking out of what is undeniably a fart. So, we love Cindy's. The world is made of Cindy's. I want to say that this period of time was also like a very big wake-up call about love. And, you know, I want to say this isn't a try-it-at-home manual. We don't have to get catastrophic illness to come back into our bodies. You know, you don't have to go home and do this. You can actually read the book and not do this. That's why we write, to tell stories so we prevent suffering. But one of the things that kept me alive was that we were building the City of Joy. And the City of Joy is owned and directed and built and dreamed of by the women of Congo, but the promise V-Day had made on this side of the water was that we would find the right resources and bring the people to the opening to shed advocacy on the project. And I knew that the director, Christine Schuler Describer, who is my hero and who I literally get up every morning for because she's the bravest woman I know. She's been running City of Joy, and she was there in the middle of this crazy building in the middle of a country at war. And I knew I couldn't die because I promised her we would get that city open. So every single day, no matter what state I was in, whether I was drugged on oxycodone or vomiting on chemo, I would call her and pretend I was fine. And she would pretend she was fine. And we pretended for months, and it went on like this, but we saved each other and we kept each other going. And I will say, when you have something to live for outside yourself, it's much easier to live. Anyway, that was going on, and all around me, there was so much love. I said to Toast at one point, if I die, it's going to be seriously embarrassing to have this much love and to have died. And I had a revelation in the middle of all this one day, and this scan is called A Burning Meditation on Love, and I want to share it tonight. Before cancer, love was something you succeeded or failed at. It was like a corporate activity. You won or lost. People loved you, and then they didn't. As with trees, I had missed the point. The men I, in theory, had loved and who, in theory, had loved me had all disappeared. After years of involvement, not one found his way to my loft during those long, burning months. I received a two-line email from my first husband of 15 years, a card from a partner of 13 years, and no word from another lover of equal duration. Later, I heard he was insulted I hadn't reached out to tell him I had cancer. No blame, really, just the facts. I had failed at love or at the story I had bought about love. As I rode my burning body down to the bottom of the world, I passed through the ghosts and the glories of those love affairs, the hideous moments and the tender ones. Honestly, not much remained. No resentments, no longings, and that was most painful. To think that at 56 I had come to this, no lover, no mate, and no nurturing memories. Despair burned in me. There were days when the leaves of my romantic failings made a bonfire inside me. The story I had been living about love was now clearly over. The landscape was charred. There was no way forward or back. While this fire raged in me, some other alchemic dance was happening all around me. I couldn't see it at the beginning. It was MC cooking me soft-boiled eggs at 5 a.m. to calm my stomach. It was Amy, who I hardly knew, stopping by unexpectedly to rub my feet. It was Nico coming from Italy for an entire month and turning my loft into a summer ashram. It was Nico shaving my head with a pink Bic razor. It was Avi and Naomi showing up with pajamas and Bolivian quinoa. It was my granddaughter, Coco, packing my suitcase the night before I would go to see my mother for the last time. It was my sister showing up with bad DVDs. And it was Toast, always there with the devotion of Kent and King Lear, who gently kept me engaged and fighting, always there, never wavering, never complaining. This daily, subtle, simple gathering of kindnesses stretched out across the chemo days and months was, in fact, love. Love. Why hadn't I known this was love? I was always reaching for love, but it turns out love doesn't involve reaching. I was always dreaming of the big love, the ultimate love, the love that would sweep me off my feet or break open the hard shell of my lesser self, the love that would bring on my surrender, the love that would inspire me to give everything, the love that, as I lay there, it occurred to me that while I'd been dreaming of this big love, this ultimate love, I had, without realizing it, been giving and receiving love for most of my life. As with the trees that were right in front of me, I had been unable to value what sustained me, fed me, and gave me pleasure. And as with the trees, I was so busy waiting for and imagining and reaching and dreaming and preparing for this huge, big love that I had totally missed the beauty and perfection of the soft-boiled eggs and the Bolivian quinoa. So much of life, it seems to me, is in the framing and naming of things. I had been so busy creating a future of love that I never identified the life I was living as the life of love, because up until then, I had never felt entitled enough or free enough or honestly brave enough to embrace my own narrative. I had secretly gone on ironically and created the life I must have wanted, but it had to be covert and off the record. Chemo burned away the wrapper. And suddenly I was in my version of life. Thus began the ecstasy, the joy, the pure joy of a spiritual pirate who finds the secret treasure. And so after the last takedown, which is when the bag went away, which was the hardest part of the process. It's always the last miles that's the hardest. I went back to the Congo for the opening, and I want to tell you a wonderful story. You know, the doctors at the Mayo, who were my doctors, were originally not my doctors. They were people I was working with, because Dr. Denis Mukwege, who's one of my, just my spiritual leaders because of the work he does in the Congo and the commitment he has to the women of Congo and that he's given his life. He's an OBGYN on the front lines of sewing up women as fast as the militias are ripping them apart. And literally 4 months ago, there was an assassination attempt on his life, and they killed one of the closest people to him, and he had to leave the country, but he's back. I was just with him in February, living essentially in a barbed wire cage at the hospital with 7 bodyguards every time he goes out. And he doesn't leave because he's there for the women of the country. And he's an extraordinary person. Anyway, I had met the doctors at the Mayo Clinic long before I got sick, and they had heard about Panzi Hospital, and they were planning a trip to go and support Dr. Mukwege, and I was the activist helping them do it. And when I got sick, I called them, and they told me to come right away, and they became my doctors. So when I went back to the Congo for the first time after I was sick, they came with me. And my surgeon operated on the women at Panzi Hospital, which was just an amazing thing. And when I went back, I was 30 pounds lighter, and I had no hair, and I was temporarily incontinent. And I was very much in a similar state to many women at the hospital, because when women are raped, they get something called fistula where they're incontinent, essentially. And when I got back, the women looked at me, and there was nothing to say. They knew, I knew, and so, of course, what they did was starting dancing, because that's all you can do in moments like that. And we started to dance, and it was an incredible moment for me, because I was ground zero. I was in my body, and I was in the body of those women, and I was in the body. I was just in the body. And we danced, and I think it was in that moment when I really understood what 1 Billion Rising could be, because I saw the power of dance. I saw the power of women's bodies able to transform suffering into joy, to transform pain into power, to transform what is absent into what is whole. And we danced and we danced and we danced. And I want to tell you that City of Joy did open. We just celebrated our 3rd graduating class. There are 90 women there at any given time. They come for 6 months. It's the most beautiful place in the world, as far as I'm concerned. There's bougainvillea that's thick now. There's roses taller than I am. There's bunnies and sheep and goats. And women come, and they are in incredible group therapy where they're healed, and their stories are able to be expressed, and their souls are nurtured, and they're trained in everything from computers to agriculture to civics to rights, and then they go back and they become amazing leaders and forces of change in their communities. And we're already seeing like unbelievable things happening where women have started cooperatives and are standing up to the government and are building restaurants and are changing their families. And all these women are 15 to 30 and they are the future of the Congo and they are going to rock that country in a few years. So it's really incredible what's happening. I want to close with the very last section of the book, which is called Second Wind, and I feel right now that I'm most definitely in my second wind. As a matter of fact, I feel, you know, when I began this journey, I had a lot of anxiety about death, and then I died, and that was done. So now we're on to the next second wind, and, you know, you think I'm kidding, but I'm really not. I think when someone says to you, you have stage 3/4 cancer, you go, I'm dead. That happened. And you kind of hit the rock bottom of existence and you die. And then if you are lucky enough for whatever reason to get to breathe another day, you're in the second wind. And you realize you can do anything now because you're dead, so it's okay. And so I want to just close with this because I feel like in many ways I'm in my second wind, but I think we're also in our second wind as human beings. And the big wind is coming and it turns out it's us. And we've got to really be bolder now, and we've got to be more daring, and we've got to trust what we know. So I want to just close with this for all of you, and in the hopes that you'll rise next year, but that you'll rise every single day. You'll rise every single day to what is being called on us to rise to. Every vision is necessary now. Every instinct must be awakened. The wind does not turn away. It blows through everything. Do not be afraid. There is no more winning and losing. We have already lost. Even the so-called winners feel that way. That is why they can't stop self-destructing. Step off the wheel of winning and losing. Of course there is risk. Of course it is dangerous. I wish I could make this easy. I wish I could tell you there is nothing to lose. Lose everything. That is where it begins. Each one of you will know in what direction you need to move and who to take with you. You will recognize the others when you arrive. Build the circles, listen to the voice inside, and when they come and say, this is the only way, only some can profit, we need the oil, we need the drilling, the reactors, the tar sands, the fracking, the coltane, the coal, stay tight in your circles, dance in the circles, sing in the circles, join arms in the circles, surrender your comfort. We must be willing to go the distance. We must be willing to leave the kingdom and surrender the treasures. We are the people of the second wind. We who have been undermined, reduced, and minimized, we know who we are. Let us be taken. Let us turn our pain to power, our victimhood to fire, our self-hatred to action, our self-obsession to service, to fire, to wind. Wind, be transparent as wind, be as possible and relentless and dangerous. Be what moves things forward without needing to leave a mark. Be part of this collection of molecules that begins somewhere unknown and can't help but keep rising. Rising, rising. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you all so much. Before we start the questions, I just wanted to mention that after we finish, everyone is going to have a chance to have a book signed. We're going to come up from this aisle right here. because there are so many of us, thank you so much for coming and having so many here. We are not going to personalize books. In that way, everyone will get a chance to get a book signed and to really see Eve, and she won't be having to think, how do you spell Dolores? I hope that will work beautifully. As you know, our volunteers and staff will help you get it all done very, very smoothly. The first question, I have four or five of this question, and it is, how can we get involved? We want to be part of V-Day, but how can we specifically work with the women in the Congo?
Okay, great question. Thank you. I'm going to really be just really blunt about this. You know, everybody wants to come to the Congo, and that's wonderful, but that's not what the women need, okay? What the women need is financial support, okay? It costs us $900,000 to run City of Joy a year, and I'm very proud to say that through the incredible support of Wendy Schmidt and the 11th Hour Foundation, we just bought an amazing farm. It's called the V World Farm. It's 350 hectares of the most beautiful land in the world. We have tilapia ponds. We have pig farming. We have just fields of all kinds of beans and maize and all kinds of products. And it will be a women's cooperative where women will not only turn their pain to power, but they'll turn their pain to planting. And it's we're really creating a model where women turn their trauma back to life in all different forms. And what we need the most is money, to be honest with you. I mean, that's where our energy is going, is raising the money to keep both those ventures alive. We have so many people now. What's happening is that because City of Joy is a national program, and women come from all over the country now, they're vetted very carefully because women have to agree to be leaders to come to City of Joy. But now everybody in the Congo wants to come, and rightly so, because they get healed and they get a life. And you know, we'd like to keep doing this, and we're hoping after 5 years we'll have an incredible model. We'll iron out a lot of the problems, and you know, and made it work in the ways we want to. And we'll have a template that we can possibly take to other places, because if it's true, and I know it's true, that one out of three women on the planet will be beaten and raped in her lifetime. There's a lot of trauma on this planet. There's trauma everywhere. And we need Cities of Joys, not only in our public, but in our hearts. We need to start creating Cities of Joys everywhere, where we can turn and go through this process of turning pain to power and turning pain to joy, turning pain to joy. Because I will tell you, in the Congo, I have never seen or known joy until I went to the Congo. I've never known gratitude until I went to the Congo. I've never seen the power of joy. And so you can help us by raising money. And what we have is something called the Circle of Joy. And there's a lot of people who have joined it, and they've made commitments, like 3-year commitments. But you at the Dominican University could start your own Circle of Joy, where you do regular commitments to raise money for the Congo, or for V-Day in general, because we're supporting lots of programs around the world.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions I'm going to put together about rape. And one person very succinctly said, every time I open the paper, I read about rape in the military, rape by clergy, rape in the home. How can this continue to go on? Why aren't the international organizations doing anything? And how do we get these people to stop doing this?
Good question. This is what I think. I think two things are going on. I think those of us who've been working, and there are many people in this room who've been working for years on the front lines to end violence against women, we are having success in the sense that I think many more people are talking about the violence now. And I think the media is actually reporting it more now. So I'm not convinced that there's more violence going on now. I think there's much more violence being reported now. That's my own theory. That's the good news. The bad news is how much violence is going on. And what I would say is that we can do everything we want to do. We can keep creating laws. We can keep, putting articles out. But until we change the patriarchal construct that we're living in, until we change the patriarchal mandate, which is that the father is supreme and must have all the power, and women are unequal, violence sustains that method. It is the methodology that sustains patriarchy. So it is needed until we deconstruct that mentality. And that happens, That happens by the way we bring up our boys. That happens by the way men think of manhood. That happens by the way we teach girls about their bodies. You know, I was at Pali High yesterday, and I had a very moving experience there because Palo Alto High School had an incident of a girl being raped. And these two very brave young girls who edit the Verdi newspaper there decided to make an issue on rape culture, which they put out to the school where they told the girl's story anonymously. And the story is a terrible story, but it's a typical story of a girl who got drunk and a guy who, you know, took advantage of her and took her out into a field. And the drunker she got, the more he did. And eventually she passed out and she woke up naked and obviously had been raped. And when she talked about it, she got attacked and she got bullied and she got called a slut and she got shamed and she got put down. And in the discussion yesterday, I was really struck by how little boys really knew about what rape was and what sex was, because we don't talk about it. We teach math and we teach science, and we assume people don't know geometry when they're born. Well, why don't we teach sex? Why do we assume people know how to do sex? They don't. They don't. I think most of us as girls knew the first experience we had with any boy, we were like, if this is it, I'm checking out. Okay? Is there a woman here who didn't have that experience? Okay? Okay? Nobody taught them what to do, so they jumped on us. And they did everything very quickly, and then it was over, okay? And I'm saying that very specifically because if you don't teach boys about reciprocity, and you don't teach boys that it's lovemaking, and you don't teach boys how to touch, they're not going to learn that. It's not going to be something they find in the locker room. It's not going to be something they find on television. It's not going to be something they find in pornography. And it's up to us to bring up men to learn what touch is and to learn what respect is and to learn what quality is. And it's up to us to teach girls what to expect and what their bodies are and what their bodies need and what their bodies demand and what pleasure is and what they should be getting in return for what they're giving. And not that it's one way and one-sided. And I also just want to say that I think the tyranny of patriarchy has destroyed men's hearts. It's destroyed men's hearts. It's separated men from their hearts. And that tyranny in some ways is worse than the tyranny that's been committed against women because we still have our hearts intact. And to live without your heart is a terrible thing. It's a terrible thing to do to anyone. So part of it is we have to reconstruct and allow boys to live in their hearts. And when they cry, not condemn them, but encourage them. And when they feel lost, to say it's okay to be lost. We're all lost. Join the club. And not to pretend like you know where you're going when you have no fucking idea where you're going, okay? Because we don't know where we're going. And we all get to be lost together and nobody has to pretend anymore. But part of that is that that's the work. And there's so much other work that we can do. But it begins in our homes. It begins in our hearts. That's where it starts. You know, that's how we'll end rape culture. That's how it will end. When we don't need the father any longer to dominate us and oppress us and hold us and mute us and silence us. But where the father comes down and is joined in the circle. So we get to be together in this journey.
I think we should stop. I think that is a perfect ending, and I hope that you come through and have your book signed.
Thank you, everyone, and I hope you'll rise next year. Please rise. Thank you.
Thank you.